Following Up is our new Without Borders podcast series, where we explore the world of media through the eyes of journalists. Join us as we deep dive into journalists' careers, uncover their daily working lives, the priorities and challenges they're facing, and how they're adapting to today's changing media landscape. Each episode, the media specialists at Taito are putting journalists in the hot seat and delving into the topics and stories that they really care about and getting the inside scoop on best practice for media relations.
Hello and welcome to the fourth episode of Following Up. In this series, we interview some of Europe's most respected journalists to get to know them better and understand their vision of the media industry. In today's episode, we're joined by Thomas Sema, Editorial Projects and Development Manager at Euronews, which is a European news network. Thomas has been working as a journalist since 2005 and has contributed to Euronews in various roles for the past 7 years. I'm Sophie, and I specialise in UK media relations at Taito.
And I'm Pauline, a French media specialist at Taito.
Welcome to the Following Up podcast, Thomas.
Thank you very much for having me.
Excellent. Right, well, let's get straight into our first questions. We'd love you to give us a quick overview of Euronews, as well as the network's focus areas and audience, please.
For sure. So Euronews is actually celebrating this year its 30th anniversary. So all the way back in 1993, we were created as a sort of European answer to CNN on the, you know, after the first Gulf War. A lot of European broadcasters were like, wow, what CNN did was incredible. Everybody was tuned into CNN. We need something like that in Europe. And public broadcasters in Europe came together with this idea of doing the first news channel that's pan-European and in multiple languages. And those two North Star objectives, so to speak, have been consistent for the past 30 years. The way our news is organized and was organized and who it belonged to has evolved, obviously. And today we are an international TV channel and website, plus apps, plus social, of course. And we broadcast and publish content in 12 languages. So some European, some extra European languages, including Farsi, Arabic, and Turkish. And you could say our audience is both a mix of people who are looking for hard news, because we are a news channel, 24/7 news channel, and people who want to stay informed regarding what's going on in Europe. Especially we have a renewed focus in Europe for the past year or so, after a change of hands in the company. And yeah, so TV and digital audiences, decision makers, travelers, and news junkies like myself.
Thank you. And what is your role currently at Euronews? And what does a typical day of work look like for you?
So I maybe if I rewind a little bit, I started as Euronews a while ago as a journalist on the digital side, always never on the TV side. And today I'm part of the business development team. I have been for the past 2 years, and I'm a bridge role between the newsroom and the team that's more responsible for some of the strategic projects and development projects, with of course an interest in diversifying revenues, because we are a privately owned channel and it's something that we need to pay attention to, obviously. And so I don't really have a day-to-day, contrary to maybe some journalists who, you know, they come in and they have really strict rituals throughout the day, you know, the morning meetings with the team discussing ideas, and then going on your day with your stories. My role is more project-based, and in that sense, I have more maybe weekly touch points instead of day-to-day. For the past year or so, I've been tasked by the CEO to be a editorial project manager on the current ongoing transformation of the company. We are redeploying our staff and resources throughout Europe, and so I am helping the editorial top management on those questions.
And before this, you worked as Euronews's VR editor. So it would be great if you could tell us a bit about what that role entailed and how how Euronews is bringing VR technology to life through its coverage. And also a tag onto that question, what is the future of immersive journalism in your eyes?
So we indeed started quite early, I think, in Europe doing VR and 360 video, which are slightly two different things. One use actual videos, a recording of actual scenes. The other one is recreated in CGI or digital assets. So we initially started doing some, thanks to some external funding that we secured with major tech companies, let's say, and manufacturers, not to name any names. And we got this funding, and all of a sudden somebody had to take care of it. And I was the de facto project lead on this. We've always been a very fact first, a very unbiased and neutral newsroom when it comes to dealing with news content. So we thought offering to our audience the chance of being in the shoes of someone that's leaving the scene, leaving the news literally, was a good opportunity to really experience the news. And I think immersive journalism is an experiential media in that sense. And also it's, and I'm going to be a little bit philosophical right now, but it's a de-intermediated media, meaning you take out the middleman, because since you give the opportunity to look around in a scene, you stop spoon feeding a narrative, a story, an angle, literally a camera angle to your audience, right? And this was something that was very attractive for me as an innovator and for the company as well, because back then our motto was all about all views and offering a multitude of perspective on all events. And in that sense, 360 videos was very much the perfect medium for the job. We experimented quite a lot, actually. We published over 200 360 videos and some VR experience. And I would say that as much as we loved cracking the codes and learning how to do a story in 360, the audience reception and success was not necessarily there. And this ties to your question about the future of immersive journalism. We had the most difficult things we faced was the user's habits, right? User's news consumption today is mobile first, scrolling based. And if you ask someone just to look around in a video, even on a smartphone, I'm not talking about even, you know, owning and using a headset, which is an entire different story. Well, they're not necessarily ready for that. And you can't really go against 99.5% of their consumption. All right. So I would say maybe what can be the future of immersive journalism or extended reality, XR, right? Is probably something that will use the existing devices and formats that people are used to. And I've seen some great experiments via the New York Times, just to name a few. A great experience based on AR filter, augmented reality filters that were interactive. And for instance, they covered a fire in a building in New York, killing, you know, dozens of people. But they had a really good investigation on the fire, but they had done an AR filter on what it's like to be in a room that all of a sudden it's filling with smoke. And, you know, through your phone, you could see, well, you could not see anymore, actually, you know, 10 minutes in, 20 minutes in, 30 minutes in, and then you realize how fast those things go. And in terms of experience, again, it was very potent. And you don't need a headset. You don't need to break your habits. It's something that people already use every day, and I think this is where things are going.
That sounds fascinating, and it's interesting that you say it's both a behavior and a technology issue that means that we're not quite there yet. But I think that sounds really promising for the future.
Well, do you think that, you know, with Apple now entering the game of VR, do you think that will change anything?
Well, it's possible that Apple is going to have an impact. The price tag on their headset remains a big barrier of entry, obviously. But I'm almost positive that they're building partnerships with media right now to develop news content for this new device. But I'm also, you know, I've been in the field long enough so that I remember that every year, pretty much people are saying, oh, this new headset is going to change the thing. This new headset is going to change everything. And now Apple is here. It might be amazing, but it's also $3,500, I think. And it's not going to be in everybody's hand right away.
Maybe 2024 will be the year of VR, finally.
Sure, why not? It's right the corner.
So just moving on to the types of stories that feature and do really well with Euronews, what makes a company or a spokesperson really compelling to feature? And are there any specific qualities or criteria that stand out when you're looking at which story to feature?
So, and Euronews is not the only one doing this right now, but we are dedicating a part of our coverage to niche topics, to more coverage centered around the theme, what we call verticals. Other media can call it differently, but, and I think if you want to, you know, pitch your company, pitch your client to a journalist working in those verticals, you really need to find the perfect fit between what your company is doing and what the journalist or the vertical is. And it's almost easier as well, because you can just look on the page. The content strategy is going to be very apparent. You know, oh, they cover technology through this and this and this angle. So then you just aim your pitch through this grid, right? So this worldview, so to speak. And in terms of stories per se, right now we want to focus on human stories. As you may very well know, a lot of people right now are either distrustful of media or they're simply switching off, like avoiding news altogether. And we don't want to feed them the same kind of, you know, oh, people behind a desk shaking hands kind of story, right? We want to go further than that. And those verticals are a way to do that. Obviously, things happen every day and we need to cover that as well. But if you want to, from a PR perspective, be most impactful, I think today is you really need to have a dedicated targeted strategy rather than, you know, playing the numbers game and emailing it to 600 journalists.
Yeah, it's all about like doing our research. So now in this second part of the podcast, we're keen to know a little bit more about you. And I guess my first question is that you've been in journalism for almost two decades now. And so why did you decide to become a journalist?
Yes, thank you for making me very old. it's very silly. The way I decided to be a journalist is in high school, I took a couple of friends and I decided to launch a very small newspaper in high school. It was very amateurish. We had no really idea of what we were going to do. And we basically just wrote text. You know, it was at the time where the war in Iraq was kicking up. So we were teenagers. We had lots of big ideas on what to say and what should happen in the world. And I just remember writing something and having feedback of some of my friends and some, you know, teachers as well, being like, hey, that's pretty good what you wrote. And I was like, okay, maybe let's just become a journalist. Before I had thought about maybe becoming like a lawyer or something, but it wasn't gonna work. And as many as my peers, as I'm not the only one among my peers to have this early idea of wanting to become a journalist. And I'm lucky, and I guess I'm biased now because I'm a survivor in terms of career. Not a lot of people get to do journalism professionally speaking, at least in France. It's a rather tough job market. And I think I was both lucky, but also you prepare your luck, right? I also always kept my eyes on, okay, what's new? What can be a good asset in the newsroom? And I'm talking about like 12, 10 years ago when I started working full-time in news organization. It was all about social media. That has evolved, obviously. But you know, you could pitch yourself then as somebody who I know Twitter, I know Facebook, and you knew more than the people hiring you anyway. So that's for the job part. For the culture part, I was always a very curious child. And what's better than being a journalist where you get to ask questions to complete strangers and tell people what's going on in the world? It's rewarding. It's not without difficulties, because you're exposed to very violent content sometimes, and especially when you talk about international news. The past 2 decades have been rich in wars and conflict and terrorism, and you have to protect yourself as well. And luckily right now in journalism, in other fields as well, but in journalism especially, there's a growing discussion about mental health and protecting yourself, because you just because you are yourself is a news junkie and you want to tell the story and cover what's going on, you after a point you are exposed to too much, right? It's too much.
And can you tell us the name of your first publication when you were a teenager?
Oh, so I don't remember the name of the media that we set up in high school. I did write for the local page of the local,
Le Progrès.
Exactly, Le Progrès in Lyon. But I also, and I was very proud about it at the time, I had interviewed someone for a web portal, we still call that web portal back then, about skateboard. And I was a skateboard journalist for like a hot month or two. I wrote a couple articles, and I even got to test skateboard video games.
That sounds super cool. And you mentioned your time at Le Progrès, which is a local publication in Lyon. Looking back, what changes did you witness in the way journalists work, and how do you envision the impact of AI on their work?
So I think journalists have been faced with an increased need to be on many platforms at once. And whether or not the tools exist, whether or not you get the support and training that you need to do that, really makes a world of difference in your day-to-day work. And this is where AI can come in, not so much on a generative part, because that's still very much iffy, but on the supporting part. And I taught a class on AI in the news a few weeks ago with journalism students here in Lyon. And I told them, okay, think about use case that you could have that would make your life easier. How would you use, ChatGPT or Bard to make your life easier? And some used it as a way for like, oh, it's Monday, my newsroom meeting is in an hour, catch me up on the 5 things I need to know about this week, And it could be very specific, very targeted to a specific area. So I think this is going to be very helpful for journalists, more so than creating videos or pictures out of nowhere. Any sort of ways that can help the journalist gain time, structure their thoughts, brainstorm ideas for interviews, help find sources, help find data. So like a turbocharged search engine almost.
It's great that you're kind of presenting AI as like full of opportunities. Obviously, there are a lot of other narrative that shows more of kind of a negative side of AI. Do you have anything else to say about that?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of my slides in the course were, double check, triple check, quadruple check everything that's being generated, because I mean, even the homepage of those of those tools tell you, might generate completely wrong facts and data. Like, okay, well, you got to be very careful. And the way we discussed and the way the students experimented was very much internal, not public facing. So obviously they have to double check, if you want some suggestions for an interview about rugby and you don't know anything about rugby, if this says a very specific, names or rules or stats, you gotta check them, right? But the larger ethical and legal questions are, you know, above my pay grade,
yeah.
above the students' pay grade. But they really understood as well, you know, where the some of the biases in AI can come from, because it's been trained on a specific amount and specific kind of material and cannot go against this almost, and it generates, you know, gender and racial biases.
And you previously mentioned that you were kind of a bridge between, in your current role, between the newsroom and the more kind of strategic team for Euronews. Can you like mention like the few topics that are the most relevant for Euronews in the tech or maybe business sector?
Yeah. What can I say? What can I say? What will not let me in trouble? I think what I was most excited to work on as part of this team was helping build the affiliate network, which was, and they are still, newsrooms in countries where Euronews, the brand Euronews, is very strong, but there was no localized offer, both in countries that are part of the recent member of the EU and countries who are candidate countries, right? So the tie, the link with Europe, is very important, because in 5 to 10 years, maybe a bit more depending on the country, they'll be part of the EU.
Yeah.
And you know, obviously there's a business aspect to it, but on the journalism part and the media part, which I was brought on for, seeing newsrooms be built from scratch and journalists, you know, exchanging ideas on how you can cover, do this and that, secure fundings for investigation, collaborate among those countries as well. And some of those countries were at war in my lifetime. It was pretty great. I'm less involved now that I'm project manager on their own news transformation. But, you know, every year the management would come to Lyon, or comes to Lyon, to meet and discuss. And it's always a pleasure to talk with those. There's people from Albania, Georgia, Serbia, Bulgaria, Romania. And it's for Euronews itself, it's also a plus in terms of having people, experts on the ground. You know, Euronews Romania has a border with Ukraine. And obviously, it's super helpful to have resources like that almost on the ground, almost near where the action happens. And I really, really enjoyed it. I felt really, you know, as much as I was outside of my comfort zone joining a business development team as a journalist, there I felt like I had a good impact.
Yeah. So I guess like Euronews welcome like insight from PR consultants from different European countries or even their own clients to kind of bring their own perspective from their kind of cultural background on a specific topic.
There the teams were, you know, all locals, and there was a local investors working with Euronews to create those new media. And yeah, on the PR perspective, it obviously opens like a new channel, like a brand new media in the country, with new relationship to be made from between the journalist and the PR professionals from that area.
And maybe like a slightly more difficult question for you, like what was the biggest or most interesting story you ever worked on why? If you can pick one.
So I haven't been in a content production role in a while, but when I was writing in French and English, I covered a few stories that had an impact, I would say. The first one was a cross-border investigation with someone I knew in Slovakia, right after the Charlie Hebdo attack. So all the way back in 2015. And he got a tip from one of his sources in the police that police from France had come to Slovakia and talked to some gun sellers there. And he had information that it was linked to the attack at the Kosher supermarket in Paris right after the Charlie Hebdo attack. And working with this person and with my own, you know, journalistic work here, we managed to, you know, publish something that was a scoop, which was, you know, that the French police was in Slovakia. They were looking at this kind of specific deactivated weapons that are very popular in Eastern Europe. But since it's part of Schengen, those weapons are then shipped to Western Europe, fixed to become more active again and lethal again, and they were used by the terrorist in this attack. And this reporting was then picked up by, you know, other media, and then it was confirmed by major news organization like the Washington Post. So we were very much the first one to break the story. We didn't go deep, as deep as, you know, the other people reporting after. But that was a taste of what it is to actually like do like super serious investigation, like in the movies, you know. Another story I wrote about, again, it's all about terrorism, because I wrote a lot about it when it was all happening. In the videos from the ISIS, you would listen to this music, you would hear this kind of music, those chants. And I was like, that's very strange. And it was also very catchy in a way. And it was horrible to be like, oh, this music coming from ISIS is, you know, it's pretty good. And I looked into it, and it was a long history of those, it's called Nasheed, like Islamic chants. And talking to experts, talking to people, wrote a long, 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 long piece, and did not get like a scoop or any awards. But then it's now a primary source on Wikipedia and in some like academic research on the topic. So my article continues to live through this research and even on Wikipedia, which I think is funny when I see my name on Wikipedia as a, you know, as a source.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And maybe like a follow-up question, like, is there a particular interviews or meetup that you had that, you know, you remember the most, either because it was like funny or unexpected or maybe a bit awkward?
When I was a journalist, I covered trade shows for media and TV and stuff. And this is during the same kind of event. It's in Cannes, it's in MIPCOM, right? In the Cannes Film Festival Palace. I had, first of all, a panel where I was exposed for the first time to 360 video. And I was like, this is so cool. We should do that at Your News, which was very much the, you know, the inception of the idea of the whole workflow, the whole, like, the next 5-6 years of my life dedicated to the topic. And in this very same spot, the very same event, there was a adult film company using this technology, and I got to see a demo, a very soft, like very mainstream like demo, but still there was one of the actress doing interviews, right? So I got took off the headset, and the person was actually in front of me, and I think I got really red in the face during my first question, because but an interesting use of the technology for sure.
There's lots of great uses for video technology. Absolutely. On a different note, you have taught journalism in both France and in the US. Can you tell us a bit more about that experience and what it's been like for you?
Yeah. In a strange way, I almost wanted to be a journalism professor before I wanted to be a journalist, or I couldn't separate the two. And I got first opportunity to do that at my alma mater in Lyon, at Sciences Po in Lyon. And I also got lucky in the sense that what I've been asked to teach was evolving throughout the year, because there's often, you know, the saying that, you know, those who can do, those who can't teach, right? And I'm lucky enough that I can do and teach the same thing. For instance, I've been teaching, you know, media business model at the Johnson School here for the past 2-3 years now. I've taught content production, web and print, and most recently AI in the news. In the US, it was slightly different because I was there as a invited scholar. So I didn't have a specific course attached to my stay in this journalism school. I had the opportunity to guest lecture and also manage students' capstone project, which is like the end of studies project. And the level of, you know, dedication and reflection on both sides of the Atlantic are pretty impressive. Certainly more than what I was capable back back during my studies. I didn't quite do a journalism school, but it's so important for today to go through a journalism school, or so they think, the kids, that they can really give it all. And I'm also there to be like, okay, there are many ways to do journalism. There are many ways to go to where you want to go. And I do enjoy sharing the knowledge, and obviously I learn about myself and about the tools and how we approach technology, because a lot of my course are around innovation, no matter what it means, really. And I was happily surprised with some of the use case that they came up with the AI and in the media business model. I asked them, it's a 2-day course, it's a course that takes place around 2 full days, and they get to come up with a business idea for media. And there you can go beyond just, oh, this would be cool, or this would be, this isn't done elsewhere. You get to think about how you're going to broadcast or publish your content, you know, your product, your audience, your monetization, what sort of main costs are you going to be, how you're going to make the money. I already said that. And what sort of needs do you meet? You know, oh, I need my audience is, you know, I don't know, people who are young people who are very religious, and there's no medium for them today. So how could I fulfill this need in a way that, you know, for youngsters, that's you can still make it money as a business, etc., etc. I love seeing them like grasp the whole concept around almost entrepreneurship in a way. And not to say that this is the only way they'll have a job later, is to create their own media, but there's more to journalism than just, oh, I have a story idea, I'm going to write this story.
Yeah, and building on that slightly further, with regard to journalism here in Europe, or in France, and across the pond in the US, can you talk a little bit about the differences that you've seen in how people approach journalism in France or Europe and in America, in your experience?
I think, all right, the way I would look at it is, at least in France, and to some extent in the UK, there's a history of having a mainstream daily press that's politicized. And it's not a bad thing necessarily, like it's a given, it's a fact of life. In the US, to the contrary, there's throughout the 50s and 60s this idea of objective journalism. And now, more and more, especially with the polarization of the US, this is being discussed and deconstructed and criticized. There is no such thing as objective journalism. And it's a foundation of a lot of, you know, the way journalism is taught in the US. And there's a pushback from the younger generation on this. And it creates, I think, a lot of unease in mainstream coverage, you know, whether or not journalists should take a stand. And in Europe, it's less of an issue, at least in France. Like, yes, different newspapers historically have political leanings, right? You're not going to be surprised if the main conservative newspaper has a conservative point of view, as long as they give you, you know, the facts. I think in the US, it's more troubling for them. That's a very short way to put it.
It's definitely an interesting concept, isn't it? The idea of impartiality and having an opinion and being able to be free about your opinion as a journalist. Just moving slightly in a different direction, talking about being a bilingual journalist. You were one of Euronews's bilingual data journalists, sorry, digital journalists. So can you tell us a bit more about your experience in developing articles in two languages?
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't come from a bilingual background. My parents barely speak English. So I just got into English a lot during, you know, middle school and high school through video games and cultural goods. So let's put it like that. And I had the opportunity to study in the US for a year as an exchange student. And there I joined a campus newspaper because I wanted to write in English, except it's super hard. And there's the AP style guidebook to respect. And my editor would just hand me back my articles, all scribbled in red. And I was. Felt very bad, so I switched to photojournalism there and made a lot less spelling mistakes when I was taking pictures. On professional side, at Euronews, I had right before Euronews, I had done a master's degree in journalism and media studies in Europe, and it was all in English for 2 years, you know, all day, every day, writing and reading. So I felt pretty much prepared. Plus, all my media diet was in English, and the way you construct an article in English or in French varies, but what it doesn't vary is that a good story is a good story, right? And sure, you can build your article slightly differently if you do it in French for a French public, or if you do it for an English-speaking public audience. I when I would write in both languages, and I did that for several years, I would always favor English because you say it's a more synthetic language. You can say more in fewer words, and there's a broader range of vocabulary to choose from, and the grammar is less hard as well. I would always, even today, I would always make more mistakes in French than I do in English, at least when I write. And yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah,
Well, I think
English grammar is so simple compared to
that's
French
you're
grammar.
the first person I've heard to say that actually. Very interesting.
When you know French, when you're a French speaker and you learn English, it's rather easy. And it's even there's almost like a cheat code because of the history and William the Conqueror in 1066, the fancy vocabulary in English is French. It's French based because that was the language of the noble and the nobility back then. So when you come from French and you learn English, you already possess the fancy kind of verbs and words that people use. The less fancy words come from the Saxon from before.
Wow, that makes a lot of sense. And this would explain why your English is so good.
No, thank you.
Well, now we can talk slightly about people who are potentially non-bilingual and speaking to a non-English speaking journalist. So, for example, some of our clients who will be speaking to journalists for the first time for whom English is not their first language. Is there anything that you think these people should sort of keep in mind to ensure that nothing is getting lost in translation when they're speaking to a non-native English speaker?
Yeah, the first thing I can think about is the metric system, right? Please adopt the metric system if you're gonna send us a press release around like pounds and inches or whatnot. Like it doesn't translate literally. I think it is okay to reach out to someone who you're not sure speak good enough English with an English press release with a call or whatever. Make sure you're even more targeted because the time and effort it's going to take this person to fully dedicated resources to understand your message will it's more demanding, right? So if it's only vaguely relevant or not relevant at all, not only is they're not going to bother, but you're never going to get their attention anymore. You're gonna get like in a blacklist somewhere, and your emails will never be opened again. I think it's also important to make sure that you, as a PR professional, is willing to go the extra mile if they get, I'm talking about the metric system, going the extra mile, go the distance, make the extra effort. If this person then reach out to you, that the discussion might be a bit more clunky, or they might need more information or more time to process it, and simply because they are doing the effort and you should be able to match that effort.
Moving on from this, we're keen to know a little bit more from, like, from your point of view, like how journalists and PR professionals can work better together. I guess my first question is, you know, there are a lot of kind of misconceptions around journalism. What do you think is the one thing you would like a PR professional and their client to know about the role of a journalist?
That journalism is not the production of journalists is not just a decision of the journalists themselves. It's an industry. We have bosses, our bosses have bosses. Everybody has different objectives. We have standards, we have rules. So just because you might have a good relationship with a journalist doesn't mean they do whatever they want, or that they can, you know, transmit your message the way they want to, you want to, sorry. And it's newsrooms up to this day, or at least in my experience, are very much triangular or pyramidal organization. And because of the need to be on all the platforms at once, and the search for a sustainable business model, and the distrust from the audience and the news avoiders, the level of risks medias are ready to take right now is limited, even much more so than 5 to 10 years ago. And so you have to think about that as well when you're a PR professional and you want to reach out to a journalist. Okay, they have short-term objectives, and then they have survival objectives, financial and simply in terms of, you know, the role of media and journalism in Western societies, which is being, and I'm not being, you know, fascist or political, but it's being threatened. Because a lot of people have stopped caring, a lot of people don't pay for news, and those who do are interested by a specific kind of news that might not be what really needs to be taught, and public broadcasters are being threatened, etc. So if you want to pitch a story, how does it fit in the media strategy, right? You almost have to think, what can I do for this journalist, right?
Yeah, I guess that would be your main advice to any kind of young PR professional starting up.
Yeah. And also, if you really help a journalist finish a good story, you get the quote they need, you get the data set they need to do like a nice visualization, you get the access they need, they will remember even more so.
Yeah.
Because you help them in a tense global system situation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess it's all about trying to make the life of the journalist as easy as possible.
That would be amazing.
Yeah, especially knowing how busy a journalist is.
Yes. I understand that sometimes, let me rephrase, I didn't have to deal with too many PR professionals in my career because I was not necessarily like a specialized journalist.
Yeah.
But when I was able to reach the right person giving me the answer that I need, and I don't mean the right answer for my story, I mean the information, the right piece of information, not the information that I necessarily wanted to hear. It's so helpful, and I know you're busy, and I know you have other clients, or actually I don't know how you work, but a prompt and relevant answer goes a long way.
Yeah. And how many emails do you think a journalist at Euronews receive per day? If you can give an estimate.
The thing is, no matter how many emails and no matter what the internal communication tool you might choose as a media company, people will still rely on email. So you have both the internal email and the external email. You could get, I don't know, 20 emails a day if they're relevant for your stories and your beat. That's cool. But if you get 20 and nobody, they're not interesting, it's pointless.
Yeah, it's pointless.
I get too many. I don't even know how many I get, because a lot of it goes straight to my, you know, to my
Spam.
spam. So it is difficult to gauge. But the right email at the right time can be a good story.
And so at what time do you think, what's the best time to get in touch with a journalist at your own news? Like, do you have a meeting, or you should take into account?
Yeah, my colleagues do have meetings in the morning before 9, well, from 9 to 9:30. And then some other specific teams have other specific meeting, but the main meeting is at 9.
Okay.
And but we are a news channel, right? So we cover what's going on. And again, if you want to pitch a story, check the news agenda, because we're not going to talk about something that's not on the news agenda.
So you will say, like, any email before the meeting at 9 is the most helpful. Like,
or in what we called, that's going to be a bad translation, as a reaction to a story.
Okay.
Like, oh, this big thing happened. I know you are interested. It's everybody else covering it. Let me suggest a specific guest for you that hasn't talked, but is super relevant because they've been working on it for X amount of years, blah, blah, blah. So, because you can be sure that, you know, people in the newsroom are trying to find interesting guests, whether it's for an on-air interview or just as a quote. And that's one way you can be useful, for instance.
Right.
And just jumping in on that point, so when it comes to things like data and statistics, how important are sort of numbers and figures to you when you're developing an article? And do you get a sense that there's kind of data fatigue emerging from journalists because there's so many people commissioning research and so many different kind of studies done on the same topic, often contradicting each other? What's your take on that sort of research that's commissioned by people?
I think it's a matter of push and pull, right? If you come as a PR professional with, hey, we've done this survey, X amount of people say that our solution is better than the competitor, or not something as blatant, but anything where you have an agenda to push the story, in that case, the journalist will be wary of the data, because it would come from what they see as not a, it's trustworthy, but there's an agenda, it's biased, right? However, if you're being reached out to by a journalist and they need information to highlight a point, or, you know, you work for like a representative of a large group, it's okay, well, inflation is going on, you know, what sort of impact did it have on your bottom line, on your consumer basis, whatever. And then if you're ready to share interesting and new numbers, you know, that's something that has been communicated before, here you will only be one part of the story, but you will be an important part of the story. It's the sort of anecdotal evidence that journalists love to gather in pieces to show some level of, you know, when you paint a story, it would be one brush stroke of your story. And then it's understood that it's not like a thorough research claiming to represent the entire or the state of the industry at one point. It's, we reached out to this major group and they tell us that, I don't know, it was minus 25% in sales because of the increase in costs, for instance.
Yeah, that makes sense. So providing genuine value rather than trying to own the story end to end.
Yeah. And I know it can be very, the temptation can be strong to commission a story or commission a survey that's a little out there, that's a little quirky, that's going to, you know, draw clicks and then push it. But honestly, as a journalist, maybe I do one or two of those, and then I'll push back against my editor telling me to do it. Like, listen, is there a survey? I have no way to check, and I don't even know the methodology of the survey and how it's been done. I think there's a growing data literacy among young journalists, especially. Not saying they all want to do data journalism, but they are more aware today that, hey, look, you always have those kind of articles, right, about, you know, condom brands doing surveys or whatnot, you know. Yeah, you do one and then you stop because it's not really, there's no added value to use a term that you use.
And in your opinion, is there a specific story or topic in tech that you believe deserves more attention that people aren't talking about enough?
Specifically in technology?
I'd say, yeah, technology and business.
I'm trying to think what my colleagues from our tech vertical have published recently, so I don't claim they haven't done their job properly.
Or I could ask the question a different way. On the contrary, do you think there's one story that media should discuss less, that you'd love never to hear about again?
There's one very specific story that I really wish we wouldn't hear anymore, and I hope they're not clients of yours. It's the most powerful passport in the world story that comes up every year, and it's always based on this single source that's, they're selling the passports, or they're very much involved in this industry of like golden passports. And I wish we would stop giving them so much airwaves and airtime and page views, because they, yeah, it's been linked to some other unsavory activities because of who buys those passports. But in terms of things I would like more, maybe I would like to see a better, let me rephrase. I would like to see PR and researchers working better together, so journalists have a better time, or it would make it easier for journalists to cover important new studies, findings, etc. Because either it's small studies or not relevant studies that are being sensationalized, or it would be tricky. It would be easy to miss like the one big discovery that might have an impact that we should talk about. But maybe it's in a small university with less resources and no communication department. Don't know how that would work, but. And I know I know that communicating around science is difficult, especially right now. But I think everybody in the industry, in the media industry, I mean, I'm involving everybody, could do a better job.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Thomas, for joining us today. I've really enjoyed getting such an honest perspective on your work and how we can work with you better. So thank you very much for giving us that insight into your world. I hope our listeners have also enjoyed this conversation with Thomas as much as we did. If you have any feedback on today's episode, please contact the Taito team on LinkedIn or X, or comment on the video episode of this podcast on YouTube. You can also drop us a line at hello@taitopr.com. Thanks for listening and see you soon.
Following Up is a Without Borders podcast series produced by pan-European B2B tech PR and communications agency Taito. You can find every interview on YouTube and all major podcast platforms. Subscribe now so you never miss an episode.